Howdy and welcome to Thin Air, news with an altitude from small town public radio in the Rockies and Four Corners. I'm John Kovash.
I'm Jennifer Thurston. Howdy. This month, what's it like being an AIDS victim in a small town in the Rockies?
I shared with my boss that I was HIV positive, and it wasn't 24 hours later I didn't have a job.
We visit a new public radio station on the Hopi Reservation.
My dad wouldn't get out of the truck because he was listening to a song on the radio.
We take you to an unusual ski competition on Aspen Mountain.
Only 23 hours and 57 more minutes to go.
But first, some news from around Thin Air country.
Last month, timber giant Louisiana-Pacific declared it would accept no more logs at its wafer board plant near Olathe, Colorado. LP cited severe market conditions and could close the plant as early as May 1st.
Controversy continues over the proposed Piano Creek Resort on a 2,600-acre in-holding in the pristine East Fork Valley near Pagosa Springs. Opposition has included the Durango-based San Juan Citizens Alliance, which maintains a website that includes meta tags that lead readers to other critics of the project. Last month, the attorney for the developer demanded that the tags be dropped from the website because the name Piano Creek is proprietary. Mark Pearson, director of the Alliance, called it a ludicrous assault on free speech.
Outgoing President Clinton's roadless initiative has stirred debate all over the Rockies, and Steamboat Springs is no exception. In the Route National Forest, 50 miles of roads and 41 miles of trails would be closed. In public hearings, most opposition has come from hunters.
But a new report by the Congressional Research Service concludes that the government would lose at least $20 billion if Republicans axe the roadless initiative. That's the cost of maintaining logging roads, restoring trashed watersheds, and continuing with money-losing timber sales. The study says logging is not economical on most of the disputed lands, and that since 1988, employment has continued to grow in counties where logging has declined.
This year, organizers of Aspen's Gay Ski Week festivities wanted to hang rainbow flags on Main Street, touching off critical letters and a review by the town council. In an Aspen Times poll, 54% of readers were against the rainbow flags. The Aspen Highlands Ski Patrol has opened up new terrain that starts at the very top of 12,400-foot Highlands Peak, the same terrain that killed three patrollers in an avalanche in 1984. So far, hundreds of skiers have taken the 45-minute hike to the top. Snowmass Village is poised to ban smoking in all bars and restaurants in reaction to a petition signed by 346 residents. And in a special election, Snowmass voters also approved a 16-unit affordable housing project. A proposed new mall and commercial center in Carbondale, Colorado, is still raising concerns among locals. John Stroud reports from KDNK.
The developer of the controversial Crystal River Marketplace shopping center in Carbondale appears unlikely to adopt a full-blown grid street design. According to Dan O'Connell of Crystal River Development, current market studies suggest that it's more efficient and profitable to build all at once rather than in phases. O'Connell was responding to a letter forwarded to him this week by the group Mountain Folks for Global Justice. The alternative vision also includes a transit center, affordable housing, and green building materials and energy-efficient building and lighting design. O'Connell said the developers had looked at a grid street design from the very beginning, but decided that it would end up creating a new downtown, which they didn't want to do. As for the phasing suggestion, he said they have enough tenants lined up now to justify developing the project all at once. O'Connell said the developers are open to looking at a number of the recommendations that were presented, including use of alternative building materials, a gray water irrigating system, and other conservation measures, as well as solicitation of green-oriented businesses to locate in the shopping center.
Community radio is alive and well on the Hopi Reservation in Arizona. Here's a report from our Moab correspondent, Rory Tyler.
The Four Corners has a new community radio station, KUYI, located in Keams Canyon in the heart of Hopi Land. With a 69,000-watt signal, KUYI covers all of the Hopi Nation. KUYI's first broadcast day was December 20th, 2000. Let's listen in for a minute.
Hey, how everybody. Good afternoon. This is Bert Pulley here at KUYI 88.1 FM. We appreciate everyone, all our listeners out there listening. It's an exciting day. We've got the Thunder Creek Singers here. It's a birthday song to Gloria Lopez. So, Gloria, you can go ahead, and this one's for you. And they're going to go ahead and sing an honor song. So here they go. You've got the Thunder Creek Singers coming at you.
Susan Brain is KUYI's station manager.
People were concerned about losing the Hopi language. So one of the values that they put on having a Hopi radio station was to help preserve the language and the culture. And then just, you know, hearing Hopi stories told by Hopi people, that's very important and that's very empowering.
But then also there's a lot of reggae.
Lots of country western. You know, we have to provide something for everyone. The community response has been awesome. We've been hearing stories daily. My dad finally got off the couch and turned the TV off to, my dad wouldn't get out of the truck because he was listening to a song on the radio, and he stayed in the truck until the song was over. It seems to me that Hopi people are really, really proud of this station.
Reporting from Hopi Land, Fourth in Air, I'm Rory Tyler.
Last month, many thin air stations began carrying daily reports from the Colorado State Legislature, thanks to KGNU's Sam Fuqua and funding from the Needmore and Edinger Foundations and the Gay and Lesbian Fund of Colorado. Fuqua has already covered many issues, including the status of the Colorado labor movement.
The unions united will never be defeated.
About 400 union members gathered on the west steps of the Capitol in Denver on the opening day of the state legislative session. Several Democrats walked out on the balcony outside the second-floor Senate chamber and waved to the crowd. They were cheered like kings and queens and urged to come down and join the rally. And they did come down and poured out their gratitude. Dan Grossman is a Democratic representative from Denver and House Minority Leader.
We look for people that we could champion and issues that we could champion. We look to labor, and labor responded with a resounding yes, and we are grateful.
Labor's help was key to the Democrats gaining control of the state Senate, and they narrowed the gap in the Republican-controlled House, picking up two more seats. Ellen Gollenbeck of the Colorado AFL-CIO stresses the importance of new Democratic power in the Senate.
It means that regressive, anti-union, anti-family legislation is not going to get passed. And that there's a possibility that more progressive, pro-family union legislation can get passed, at least through the Senate. We know we've got our work cut out for us in the House.
That legislation includes a pay equity proposal to make sure women get paid the same as men when they're doing the same job. Unions will also back a bill that would require employers to give some time off to parents who want to attend some of their kids' important school activities. And they want to get rid of an obscure state law that requires workers to vote twice when they want to create a unionized workplace. Labor won't have to worry about right-to-work legislation. That's a law in place in some other western states that allows employees in a unionized workplace to choose whether or not to join the union. Supporters say workers deserve that freedom of choice, but labor says it gives workers who opt out a free ride. They get the benefits of collective bargaining, usually higher wages and better benefits, without paying dues. Republican State Senator John Andrews of Centennial is a frequent opponent of organized labor. He admits right-to-work legislation won't go anywhere the next 2 years with Democrats in control of the Senate. But Andrews is skeptical about labor's ability to be proactive.
They were really playing defense against a right-to-work law. How much offense they're going to be able to play, I doubt very much that the labor agenda will advance significantly.
About 160,000 people in Colorado are union members. At best, that's 9 or 10% of the state workforce. But Tammy Tice says union influence extends beyond those numbers. She's head of Western Colorado Trades and Labor and drove from Montrose for last week's rally.
When unions are present in a community or even in a workplace, everything is better. The working conditions improve, the living standards improve, the ability to earn a living improves, and even if it's just present in the community, it makes a difference, and that's what we're here for.
At the Capitol, I'm Sam Fuqua.
With the December opening of All Red's restaurant at the top of the Telluride ski area, Dibs on First Tracks are being promoted as part of a $21,000 private club membership. In other words, club members would get to ski first on the mountain on selected powder days. A similar program came under fire at the Steamboat ski area earlier this season, and locals in that ski town dubbed it Pay for Powder. But Ken Covina, the Forest Service coordinator for Telluride, said the ski area would have to meet a number of conditions in order to get authorization. Among those concerns would be the notion of exclusivity and who gets to go on the mountain first.
It will have to be available to the general public. We have a problem with a program that is just available to an exclusive group if public land is involved. The other thing that we added to this was that the participants would not be allowed on any of the upper mountain chairs 6 and 9 before the chair opens or, you know, to the general public.
He said that the ski area could charge for such a program as long as everyone has an opportunity to buy in, similar to the concept at Keystone, where people can purchase lift tickets to ski at night. He added that he had similar concerns about the exclusivity issue when Steamboat first proposed their First Tracks program.
They had a program in place that I had problems with. It was basically a early breakfast club. And what they did was they offered a $8 breakfast at the top of the gondola. And on powder mornings, everyone would go buy the breakfast ticket and go up to the top of the gondola and then have breakfast like at 10 o'clock. And I had a real problem with that for the same reason we're talking about. It basically, it basically allowed a certain group of people to get out before the general public could.
Steamboat has since revised their program to address those issues. Covina said he had been hearing a number of concerns about Telluride's proposal recently, and he also speculated that the program would be limited to lower intermediate lifts because of that reaction.
The skier realized that they would really be causing problems in the community if they tried to do any more than that.
You are listening to Thin Air.
For the ninth straight year, the Telluride AIDS Benefit has raised a hefty sum for the Western Colorado AIDS Project, or WestCap. The event includes a legendary fashion show where local would-be models show off clothes by big city designers. Amy Kimberly is director of the benefit.
When we get all the models for their first rehearsals, and, you know, the first thing we do is say, it's not about you.
For the second year, Telluride is also helping to prevent AIDS in Mancini, a sister city in Swaziland.
When you're dealing with HIV/AIDS in Africa, you first have to deal with poverty. So the Telluride Project, as it is known over in Mancini, is directly affecting the people. There's a great core group of people throughout Swaziland involved, as well as in Telluride.
Hundreds of people work for nothing to make the Telluride AIDS benefit happen. When you ask what inspires this, one name always comes up, Robert Presley.
I think the thing that Robert Presley taught all of us was when the benefit started, we wanted to raise money so he could get the medicine he needed. But he said, no, don't do it for me. Do it for Western Colorado AIDS Project, because there's so many people out there that need help.
My mother finally came out, Rob, are you like your Uncle Bob? And I screamed out, yes! I didn't like myself at all.
Robert also inspired local filmmaker Jenny Franks.
There was one member of the community, Robert Presley, who had the disease and was educating people in the community about it and doing a great job of raising awareness. And he helped me see a lot of things about the disease. The most important aspect of the video, Robert talked one day to me about contracting the disease as a form of committing suicide because he was very depressed and he had very low self-esteem at that time.
By small-town standards, Presley had a powerful support group in Telluride, but Franks thought this low self-esteem was symptomatic of the 350 HIV and AIDS clients in 25 counties now being served by WestCap. That became the focus of Soft Smoke, a film now being used by nursing, mental health, and law enforcement groups to educate students and adults.
He educated about the disease. He made it not threatening to anybody who lived in this town because he could tell us what it was like to have it.
Soft Smoke also dramatizes the plight of AIDS patients in small towns. Despite the growing caseload, WestCap's staff of 6 educators and case managers are still not welcome in many of these communities.
One of the most shocking things about having HIV/AIDS in small towns is, number one, if you are in a minority group, you're discriminated against at some point. Growing up, being different in a small town can put you at risk. Unfortunately, there are many small towns that are resisting that they do have a problem, and young people are suffering as a result. You know, adults might not understand that the problem exists. But young people, of course, are being young. They're experimenting and they are getting into trouble. So we have to help them. It's not evil people who are contracting this disease. It's somebody's child, and it could be your child.
Contrary to much of the U.S., most AIDS clients in Western Colorado are heterosexual and Caucasian. A high proportion are females and methamphetamine users, but Soft Smoke comes back time and again to how tough it is being different in a small town.
I shared with my boss that I was HIV positive, and it wasn't 24 hours later I didn't have a job.
They told me that I shouldn't be living here in this town with HIV. Because this town was a decent town.
Growing up gay in a small community can have far-reaching effects on how people feel about themselves.
I grew up in small rural towns in western Colorado, and it's very common to certainly be called names and intimidated and harassed and threatened as well as beat up. And it's sort of interesting to see how many folks who are, you know, good strong members of this community now as adults were actually jerks as kids.
Right now, one of our largest groups of new infections are, in fact, in people who are newly single in midlife and then have undertaken activities that have gotten them infected. So we're finding many people that are in their 50s and 60s, even in rural communities, that are infected now and are just finding out about it.
Ultimately, Colorado's AIDS activists take hope in the fact that AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases can all be prevented. WestCap expects its caseload to continue growing for at least 2 or 3 years. Meanwhile, we leave the last word to Robert Presley, who died in July of 1997.
You don't get AIDS and die. You get AIDS and you have years of ignorance to deal with, years of arguing and fighting just to be treated as an equal, years of dealing with your family, and years to regret that you ever got the disease.
When you're growing up in a small town, bad skin, bad eyes, gay and fatty, people look at you funny. When you're in a small town, my father worked in construction. It's not something for which I am suited. Oh, what is something for which you are suited? Getting out of here.
What prompts skiers to hurtle down Aspen Mountain in the dark at speeds approaching 100 miles per hour? Marilyn Gleason reports from KDNK.
In the starting gate, Switzerland, Arno Honecke and Robert Motze.
By the time the 24 hours of Aspen got started, it was already 24 hours late, maybe even a year and 24 hours late. In December of 1999, Australian ski racer Stephen Lee had his bags packed and his skis waxed, ready to come to the United States to compete in this one-of-a-kind endurance downhill race. But a persistent dry spell in Colorado and a phone call canceled his travel plans.
It was the day before we left. We're packed and ready to go from Australia, and they rang us and said it's been canceled. So unfortunately, we didn't make it over last year. But
at high noon this December 17th, the scheduled start time, clouds skimmed the border of sky and ridgeline on Ajax with the speed of a time-lapse film and piled up against each other as high winds shook the gondola cars suspended high above the slopes. This time it looked like snow, not the lack of it, might end the race. Lee, a three-time Olympian with 10 years on the World Cup circuit, said he was accustomed to delays.
It's, you know, that's such a part of the speed events. You know, you hurry up to get ready, then the decision comes and you wait.
December 18th dawned clear and cold, with a little fresh snow, a perfect day for going fast.
Well, let's bring him on their first lap, the U.S. men, Christian Wall and Alan Meyer.
Conditions must be right for this small international field of elite skiers to race in teams for 24 hours straight.
Only 23 hours and 57 more minutes to go.
In this year's race, 10 teams of two racers came from New Zealand, Canada, the U.S., and five European countries, with racers as old as 40 and as young as 20. Two women's teams raced side by side with the men, representing the U.S. and Aspen. Half of the racers were former members of national ski teams. Others raced on junior national teams or on the FIS circuit. The roster also included a national free skiing champion and U.S. national telemark champion Heather Paul from Crested Butte. Without sleep, these racers let their skis seek the fastest line down the mountain's 3,267 vertical feet in an unbroken succession of downhill runs. Racers have been clocked as fast as 96 miles per hour through the Spar Gulch section of the course. Racers can eat and drink and recuperate mentally and physically only on the 14-minute gondola rides between runs.
Ireland, 5 seconds. Woo! 3, 2, 1.
In the gondola building, a bucket brigade of a half a dozen volunteers hustle the racers out of their bindings and onto the gondola cars.
Skis!
Many of the challenges the racers face are unique to this race. Besides exhaustion, the skiers must endure bitter cold temperatures on one of the longest nights of the year, changing snow conditions and transitions from daylight to darkness illuminated by 300,000 watts of artificial light. Heather Paul of the Aspen women's team said that the hardest part of the race for her were the twilight times.
Dusk and dawn were the worst because the light there's no light. And you can't see anything. You can't make out features. Although you know the course really well, things still sneak up on you and you don't realize that the light's so drastically different.
Skiing on a team also presents a challenge. Both team members must complete the race to qualify. Other rules require the pairs to race in concert. It pays to stick close together. The first racer in posts the team's time unless more than 3 seconds separate the team members. Then the slower racer's time is counted. Stephen Lee.
That's something completely different to what all of us are used to as far as normal alpine racing go, where it's just you and the course. It's a little bit unnerving sitting behind someone at that speed, you know, and you have to put all your trust in them, and you know, you have to have faith in your partner in front that they're solid on the ski, but even the solidest skier can come unstuck at any time at that speed. And then the techniques of drafting and slingshotting is, you know, from what everyone says, pretty crucial. You can gain quite good time through good drafting and having the guy behind slingshot pass, and so you're accelerating each other the whole time.
Out of the starting gate, Canada led, dogged by the Australians, with a tenacious Swiss team in third place. The team seemed locked into their positions established early in the race, except for the unstoppable Swiss team. At about 6:30 in the evening, the Australian Lee caught an edge tangled with a fence and lost 20 seconds. It was the break the Swiss team needed to slide into second place. Shortly after midnight, the Swiss took on the Canadians, fighting for the lead at the gondola entrance and sharing a gondola car for 2 trips up the mountain. Halfway through the race, the relentless duo from Switzerland, with their hair dyed matching red, took over the race. They never gave it back. As the night stretched out, the mercury settled just under zero and stayed there. Veterans of this race tend to agree with Asia Jenkins of the Aspen Women that the darkest of the 24 hours come just before the dawn.
It was cold. We couldn't believe that the sun wasn't going to come up for another 3.5 hours. But we pulled through, and it was good. Right when the sun started coming over the mountains, we knew that it was all going to be okay.
Those hours before the dawn claimed the race's first victim. Just after 5 a.m., Richard Hansen of Team New Zealand bloodied his nose in a crash that led him to drop out of the race later in the morning. One more team would come apart before the race was over. Coming into the 23rd hour, 35-year-old Christian Wall of Taos fractured his collarbone and tore his knee in the fall that ended the race for the American men. After 24 hours of skiing and 73 runs, less than a minute and a half separated the top three finishers, Switzerland, Canada, and Australia. It took only 2 minutes and 18 seconds this year for the fastest skier to rocket down the courses, 2.69 miles. What's the first thing a racer wants to do after surviving the 24 hours of Aspen? Stephen Lee led the way.
First thing I think is going to hit the hot tub with a very cold beer.
All right. Congratulations. In that
order. For Thin Air, I'm Marilyn Gleason in Aspen.
This winter snow has been lingering on much of the high country desert, but when it melts, it will again uncover a delicate ecosystem. Once again, Rory Tyler.
Visitors to the Colorado Plateau are regularly advised to avoid crunching the cryptos, cryptos being the lumpy black crust that covers much of the desert surface. Dr. Jane Belknap is a researcher who studies soil crust.
Basically, what we have is this tiny little thin layer of living material on the surface of the soil that's maybe 3 millimeters deep. And everything else underneath is non-living. So one of the reasons it's so bad when we step on the crust out there is what you do is you smash all this underlying sheath material, and there's no one home down there to fix it. How long does it take these guys to recover? Who are you talking about recovering? Cyanobacteria come back very quickly. Mosses and lichens come back very slowly. So if recovery to you is just a surface roughness, that's more a matter of frost heaving than anything else. If recovery to you is getting all your mosses and lichens back, then you're talking about a very, very long time because they grow very slowly. Here, for mosses and lichens, we're in like in the 200 to 300 years. So it can look okay, but it's not necessarily functioning anywhere near like it used to. People always come and say, well, I ran over that area 5 years ago, and I went back yesterday, and it looks great. Well, yes, it does look great. But again, in terms of nitrogen fixation, in terms of carbon contributions, in terms of water erosion, you got a long, long ways to go.
Dr. Jane Belknap runs a cryptobiotic soil research laboratory in Moab, Utah.
Thanks once again for listening. Thin Air is brought to you by the High Country Community Radio Coalition. You might be listening to KRZA in Alamosa and Taos, KAJX in Aspen, KGNU in Boulder, KDNK in Carbondale, or KBUT in Crested Butte and Gunnison.
Or you might be hearing us on KDUR Durango, KAFM Grand Junction, KZMU Moab, KVNF Paonia, KRCL in Salt Lake City, or KOTO Telluride.
Funding for Thin Air comes from your local station and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We encourage listeners to tell us what they think of the program.
Email us at thinair@tellurideColorado.net. You can go to kgnu.org to hear previous programs.